the television, and the house lights, as if he knew people would be returning soon and didn't want to raise an alarm. The girl added to the ever-growing catalog of fleeting details glimpsed in the dark through a loosened blindfold. Black, square-toed shoes. A small flashlight, small enough that it disappeared into his left hand. Military fatigue pants. While she was tied up, he kept scrambling up the west side of the embankment and looking out at something, the girl said. Back and forth, fidgety-like. Shelby climbed the embankment. They were, as always, minutes or hours behind him. You could plant your feet in the man's footprints, but without knowing what drew him to that spot, yours was the chump's view, dumbly scanning the horizon for a hint. Overgrowth of tangled brush, fences, backyards. Too much. Not enough. Square one. The leather hood the girl described extended beneath the ear's shirt and had slits for eyes and mouth. That sounded to Shelby like the kind of hoods arc welders wear underneath their helmets. He hit up welding equipment companies for customer names. Nothing panned out. Meanwhile, the phones rang at the sheriff's department with people spilling names. The detectives tried to eyeball everybody. Guys were eliminated if they had big feet, a sunken chest, a potbelly, a beard, a wandering left eye, a limp, custom arch supports, or a sister-in-law who confided that she skinny-dipped once with her husband's younger brother and he had a big penis. The ear attacked another teenage girl, this one in Fair Oaks, on December 18th. There were two more victims in January. "Rapist strikes again, 14th time in 15 months," read the headline in the January 24th edition of the Sacramento Bee. A quote by an anonymous sheriff's detective conveyed the brittle weariness setting in. It was exactly the same as all the rest. On the morning of February 2nd, 1977, a 30-year-old woman in Carmichael lay bound, blindfolded, and gagged on her bed. After listening for a long time and hearing nothing, she worked the gag out of her mouth and called out for her 7-year-old daughter, whom she sensed was in the room. "Are you okay?" she asked. Her daughter shushed her. "Mama, be quiet." Somebody pushed down on the woman's bed abruptly and let go, as if to tell her he was still there. For several minutes, she lay with her eyes wide open against her orange and white terry cloth blindfold, listening to him breathing somewhere close by. Hypnotists elicited details about suspicious sightings. Detectives looked for a black-and-white motorcycle with fiberglass saddlebags. A black, possibly ex-California Highway Patrol car with a loud exhaust. A white van with no side windows. A biker named Don with mutton chops and a large mustache. A woman called about an employee at a local grocery store. "The man's penis," she said knowingly, "is very rough, like it's been used to death." Desperate for fingerprint evidence, the detectives tried a method called iodine silver plate transfer for lifting latent prints from human skin. Carol Daly was tasked with blowing a fine powder through a tube over the victims' naked bodies. Nothing. There were small victories. In February, a woman in Carmichael struggled with the ear for his gun. He beat her over the head. When Shelby and Daly examined the victim's head wound, they noticed a spot of blood on her hair about 2 inches from the injury. Daly snipped the bloodied hair and had it sent to the crime lab for typing. The victim's blood was type B. This spot, determined to be the ear's, was A positive. Editor's note. The section that follows was pieced together from Michelle's notes. It was around 10:30 on the night of February 16th, 1977. The Moore family, whose names are all pseudonyms, was settled into their home on Ripon Court in the Sacramento neighborhood of College Glen. 18-year-old Douglas cut himself some cake in the kitchen while his 15-year-old sister Priscilla watched TV in the living room. Suddenly, an unexpected noise capsized the ordinariness of their weekday evening, a crash that came from the backyard. It was the family's electric smoker. Someone had just hopped the fence and knocked into it. Mavis Moore turned on the patio light and peered through the drapes just in time to glimpse a figure running through the backyard. Douglas impulsively began pursuit, and his father, Dale, grabbed a flashlight and followed him through the side door. Dale found himself trailing behind as he watched his son chase the blonde-haired man who had been prowling their backyard, across Ripon Court and into the space between two neighboring residences, where the prowler disappeared over the fence. Douglas followed, and as he reached the crest of the fence, a loud pop sounded. Dale watched as his son fell backward onto the grass. "I've been shot!" Douglas cried out as his father attended to him. Another shot followed, without consequence. Dale moved Douglas out of the line of fire. An ambulance arrived and rushed Douglas to the hospital. The bullet had entered his stomach and left multiple holes in his intestines, bladder, and rectum. As the police went door-to-door conducting a neighborhood canvass, their notebooks began to fill up with details eerily similar to the descriptions detectives would hear when canvassing after an ear attack. Neighbors heard sounds in their yards as though their fences had just been scaled. One neighbor heard someone walking on her roof. Fence slats were discovered kicked out, and side gates were found open. A rolling tide of barking dogs seemed to indicate the direction of a phantom prowler. Residents in the general area reported prowler incidents and burglaries in the weeks leading up to the Moore shooting. And all witness reports, including Doug Moore's, yielded a familiar set of descriptors. A white male between 25 and 30 years old, 5'9 to 5'10, with heavy legs and sandy blonde neck-length hair, wearing a watch cap, a windbreaker, Levi's cords, and tennis shoes. Among the clues collected was the usual outlier, an intriguing potential lead that may have had no relationship at all with the incident culminating in Doug Moore's shooting, and even if it did, it seemed to offer little in the way of concrete information. A custodian leaving his shift at the nearby Thomas Jefferson School crossed paths with a pair of loiterers in front of a building on campus. One of them asked him the time as he passed, while the other appeared to be concealing something, possibly a transistor radio, beneath his coat. Both subjects appeared to be 18 or 19 years old and around 5'9". One was apparently a Mexican male with dark shoulder-length hair, wearing a blue windbreaker and Levi's, while the other was a white male in an identical outfit. The custodian had worked at the school for 7 years and was well acquainted with the regulars who'd hang around campus after hours. He had never seen either subject before. The ear hit again in the early morning hours of March 8th in Arden Arcade. The Sacramento Bee ran an article, "Rape May Be Linked to Series," about the attack. The reporter noted that the victim was separated from her husband and had a small child who was staying elsewhere Monday night. The East Area rapist has never attacked while there was a man in the house, although occasionally there have been children. If there was ever a question about whether the ear was reading his press, it was put to rest after the article was published. His next victim was a teenage girl. But after that, he targeted heterosexual couples, 11 in a row. And from then on, couples remained the main focus of his attacks. On March 18th, the sheriff's department received 3 phone calls between 4:15 and 5 p.m. "I'm the ear," a male said, laughed, and hung up. The second call was a repeat of the first. Then the third. "I'm the East Area rapist. I have my next victim stalked, and you guys can't catch me." That night in Rancho Cordova, a 16-year-old girl returning home from her part-time job at Kentucky Fried Chicken dropped her takeout bag on her kitchen counter and picked up the phone to dial a friend. Her parents were out of town, and she intended to stay at the friend's house. The call had rung 1.5 times when a man in a green ski mask emerged from her parents' bedroom, a hatchet raised above his head. This time, the victim had a somewhat better look at the ear's face, as he wore a ski mask with the center cut out. Acting on a hunch that the ear was a young Rancho Cordova local, Shelby and Daly brought over a stack of neighborhood yearbooks and watched as the victim flipped through them. She stopped on a page in the 1974 Folsom High School yearbook. She handed the book to Shelby, pointing at a boy's picture. "That looks most like him." They ran down the kid's history. Instability, check, weirdness, yes. He was working at a gas station on Auburn Boulevard. They hid the victim in the back of an unmarked car and had her peer at him from 3 feet away as he filled the gas tank. She couldn't make a positive identification. The houses had different layouts. Some of the victims were young teenagers who clutched couch pillows to their stomachs and, pain-faced and confused, shook their heads when they were asked if they knew what a climax was. Others were in their mid-30s, had recently divorced their second husbands, and were enrolled in beauty school classes and active in singles clubs. But for the detectives called out of bed in the early morning hours, the scene's record skipped with a numbing sameness. Cut shoelaces on a shag carpet. Deep red indentations around wrists. Pry marks on window frames. Kitchen cabinets left open. Beer cans and cracker boxes scattered on backyard patios. There was the sound of some sort of bag, paper rustling, or a zipper opening, as he stole engraved jewelry, driver's licenses, photos, coins, occasionally money, though theft was clearly not his driving motive, as he bypassed other valuables, and often what he stole, like a cherished wedding ring ripped violently from a swollen finger, was found dumped somewhere close by. On April 2nd, he added a twist to his method, one he would continue to use. The first couple he targeted awoke to a bright, square-lensed flashlight shining in their eyes. He gruffly whispered that he had a gun, a .45 with 14 shots, and threw a length of twine at the woman, ordering her to tie up her boyfriend. When the male was bound, the ear placed a cup and saucer on his back. "I hear the cup rattle, or bed springs make any noise. I'll shoot everybody in the house," he whispered. To the woman, he remarked at one point, "I was in the army, and I fucked a lot while I was there." That the ear may have a military connection was frequently discussed. There were 5 military installations within an hour's drive of Sacramento. Mather Air Force Base, adjacent to Rancho Cordova, had roughly 8,000 personnel alone. There was his penchant for Army Green and the occasional report of black lace-up military-style boots. Several who encountered him, including those with military backgrounds, felt his authoritative posture and unyielding demeanor were reminiscent of someone with a background in the armed forces. The dishes trick, as his unusual alarm system came to be known, struck some as a technique right out of jungle warfare. There was also the galling fact that he was outmaneuvering them. He remained free. The sheriff's department borrowed treetop cameras from the State Department of Forestry, normally used to catch arsonists. They depleted their overtime budget, sending undercover patrols to roam the neighborhoods the ear frequented. They borrowed military night scopes and movement detectors used in Vietnam. Yet he was still out there blending in, a man whose ordinariness was his mask. The sheriff's department brought in an army colonel trained in special forces techniques to help them understand the ear's tactics. "The major point in training is that of patience," the colonel told them. "The specially trained person can and will sit in one position for hours if necessary, and will not move." The ear's sensitivity to noise, he often turned off air conditioning and heating units to hear better, was a skill honed in special forces personnel. Ditto knives, knots, and planning multiple escape routes. "He can and will make use of any point of concealment," the colonel said. "Look for him in the place most unlikely for a human being to be, i.e. the bottom portion of an outhouse, the middle of blackberry bushes." The colonel reiterated, "Remember the patience. He believes he's got more stamina than anyone else, and that searchers will give up when he will not." Shelby wondered if they hadn't caught him for another reason. He noticed that they would station undercover patrols in a neighborhood he was known to frequent, but that night the ear would attack somewhere else. He seemed more aware of police procedure than the average citizen. He always wore gloves and parked outside the standard police perimeter. "Freeze!" he shouted once at a woman as she tried to scramble away from him. Shelby wasn't the only one to bring it up. The thought crossed other minds in the sheriff's department, too. Was he one of them? One night, Shelby followed up on a prowler tip. The woman who called in the tip seemed surprised when Shelby knocked on the front door and announced himself. For the last several minutes, she thought an officer was already there, she told him. She could swear she heard the sound of a police radio just outside her house. "He will let the searchers walk within an inch of him and will not move," the colonel had warned. By the end of April, the victim count was 17. The ear was averaging 2 victims a month. If you were paying attention, and most people were, it was bad. Then came May. The sheriff's department accepted an offer from a psychic who said she could identify the ear. She chanted and ate raw hamburger. They looked into having the ear's biorhythm chart done, but were told it wouldn't work without his birth date. Around midnight on May 2nd, a little over 2 weeks since the last attack. A 30-year-old woman on La Riviera Drive heard a thump outside, the same sound her young sons made when they jumped the fence from the levee into the yard. She went to the window but didn't see anything. The abrupt glare of a flashlight, the first hint of danger, startled her and her husband, a major in the Air Force, around 3 a.m. 2 days later, a man in a beige ski mask and dark blue jacket, resembling a U.S. Navy jacket, lunged out of the darkness at a young woman and her male co-worker as they walked to her car parked in his driveway in Orangevale. Both cases had the familiar smell. The hang-up phone calls beforehand, the dishes trick, the unsettling pairing, in one instance, of brutal rape followed by a break to eat Ritz crackers in the kitchen. Both couples told the detectives the ear seemed like someone straining to appear tough, a bad actor who took gulping breaths in an attempt to seem angry and unhinged. The woman in Orangevale said he entered the bathroom for several minutes. It sounded to her that he was hyperventilating in there. East Area Rapist Attacks 20th Victim in Orangevale, read the headline in the next day's B. Pressure was building at the sheriff's department. Normally, hands-off bosses became agitatedly hands-on. It was only May, and their overtime budget was nearly depleted for the year. They were elbow-deep in dead-end calls about ex-boyfriends and public works employees checking street lighting. Slouching and leisurely sipping from styrofoam cups of coffee disappeared from daily briefings, replaced by pacing and restless legs. Detectives stared at maps and tried to predict his next attack. They had a feeling he would hit next in the area around Sunrise Mall, in Citrus Heights. Reports of prowling and break-ins were emanating from there. Around 12:45 a.m., on May 13th, a family on Merlindale Drive, not far from Sunrise Mall, heard someone on their roof. Dogs in adjacent yards began barking. A neighbor called the family around 1 a.m. to say they heard someone crawling on their roof, too. Squad cars arrived within minutes. The roof creeper was gone. The next night, a block over, a young waitress and her husband, a restaurant manager, were the next victims. Disbelief set in. A roughly 10-mile corridor following the American River east into unincorporated Sacramento County was under siege. No one required context anymore. There was no, "Have you heard?" You had heard. "There's this guy" was replaced by "he." Teachers at Sacramento State gave up teaching, and entire class sessions were devoted to discussions about the ear. Any student with new information pumped for details. People's relationship with nature changed. Winter's drizzle and dense tule fog, the weather of dread, had given way to a lovely warmth, to vistas of freshly scrubbed green studded with red and pink camellia petals. But Sacramento's prized abundance of trees, all those Oregon ash and blue oaks flanking the river, were recast in their eyes, a once verdant canopy, now a hunting blind. An urge to prune took over. Eastsiders hacked off tree limbs and uprooted shrubs around their houses. Reinforcing sliding glass windows with dowel rods wasn't enough. That might keep him out, but they wanted more. They wanted to strip him completely of the ability to hide. By May 16th, a surge of newly installed floodlights lit up the east side like a Christmas tree. In one house, tambourines were tied to every door and window. Hammers went under pillows. Nearly 3,000 guns were sold in Sacramento County between January and May. Many people refused to sleep between 1 and 4 a.m. Some couples slept in shifts, one of them always stationed on the living room couch, a rifle pointed at the window. Only a madman would strike again. May 17th was the day everyone held their breath and waited to see who would die. They'd awakened that morning to news that the ear had struck for the fourth time that month, the 21st attack attributed to him in less than a year. The latest victims, a couple in the Del Deo neighborhood, told police he threatened to kill two people that night. In a single 24-hour period, between May 17th and May 18th, the Sacramento Sheriff's Department received 6,169 calls, almost all of them about the East Area Rapist. The officers responded to the call at 3:55 a.m. on May 17th. The 31-year-old male victim was outside his house in light blue pajamas, a length of white shoelace dangling from his left wrist. He spoke angrily in a mix of English and Italian. "What's the hurry?" he said to the officers. "He's gone. Just come on in." When Shelby pulled up to the scene, he recognized the man immediately. Back in November, when he and Daly had led a packed town hall discussion on the ear, the man had stood up and criticized the investigation. He and Shelby had exchanged heated words. The incident had taken place 6 months ago, and maybe it was a coincidence, but the connection contributed to the impression that the ear was brazen enough to attend events dedicated to his own capture. That he blended in, observed, remembered, and excelled at a certain kind of malevolent patience. The attack, right off American River Drive in Del Deo, near a water treatment plant, echoed the previous ones. Though this time the ear's mood, like the community's, was especially jittery. He stuttered. It didn't seem like a put-on. And he had a message to convey, one he practically spit out at his female victim with excited anger. "Those fuckers. Those pigs. Do you hear me? I've never killed before, but I'm going to kill now. I want you to tell those fuckers, those pigs, I'm going to go home to my apartment. I have bunches of televisions. I'm going to listen to the radio and watch television, and if I hear about this, I'm going to go out tomorrow night and kill two people. People are going to die." But he gave the husband, who was tied up in another room, a slightly different message. "You tell those fucking pigs that I could have killed two people tonight. If I don't see that all over the papers and television, I'll kill two people tomorrow night." He devoured Cheez-It crackers and half a cantaloupe before he left. The city awoke to a jarring headline in the Sacramento Bee. "East Area Rapist Attacks Number 23. Next Victims Die Tonight?" The article reported that the sheriff's department had consulted with a panel of local psychiatrists and concluded that the ear was a probable paranoid schizophrenic, and that he was likely in a homosexual panic because of inadequate physical endowment. The inadequate endowment detail was repeated several times in the article. Whether or not this was the kind of press the ear sought, or whether he sought press at all, was anyone's guess, as was the question of whether he'd make good on his threat to kill. May 1977 was the month the wrought iron bars went up and the all-night vigils began. When a group of 300 neighborhood men patrolled East Sacramento County in pickup trucks outfitted with CB radios. Hard acrylic panels were bolted behind windows and doors. Deadbolts were on back order. Meter readers held their identification cards in front of them and announced themselves repeatedly, loudly, when they entered people's yards. Orders for backyard floodlights went from 10 a month to 600. A letter to the Sacramento Union, typical of the time. "We used to open our windows at night for fresh air. Not anymore. We took the dog for a walk in the evenings. Not anymore. My sons used to feel safe and secure in their own home. Not anymore. We all used to sleep without waking to every normal evening's noise. Not anymore." Around this time, Shelby found himself in South Sacramento in an unmarked car with another detective on daytime surveillance detail. They were facing east, and to their left was a short street where, midway down the block, a game of tag football was being played. A car headed eastbound, going very slowly, passed by. The car's speed was unusual, but what really caught Shelby's attention was the extreme focus with which the driver watched the game. Shelby looked closer at the players. They were all boys except the quarterback, a young woman with long hair, about 20 years old. A few minutes later, the same car returned, inching by, the driver again staring intently at the players. Shelby noted the make and model of the car. When the car circled a third time, he jotted down the plate and radioed it in. "If he comes by again, let's pull him over," Shelby told his partner. But that was the last time the driver, a pencil-necked blonde guy in his early 20s, came by. His ardent concentration is what lingers in Shelby's memory. That and the fact that days later the ear would attack in South Sacramento for the first time, about a mile away. That crime scene would be the last Shelby worked on before being pulled off the case and reassigned. The license plate came back unregistered. There's a kind of proudly self-reliant, no-fuss quality that I've come to recognize in longtime Sacramentans. I once scheduled a breakfast interview at the boutique hotel I was staying at downtown. The interviewee's husband, a cabinet maker, accompanied her to the meeting. I had already ordered my breakfast, a deconstructed yogurt parfait that came in a tiny mason jar with an antique silver spoon. I encouraged my guests to get something, but when the waitress turned to the husband, he shook his head politely and smiled. "Made my own breakfast myself this morning." I literally had a silver spoon in my mouth when he said it. I bring this up only to help make sense of certain things. For example, 2 days after the May 17th attack, a local dentist publicly announced that he was contributing $10,000 to the reward, raising it to $25,000, and, with another businessman, forming the grassroots EARS, East Area Rapist Surveillance Patrol. Hundreds of local men attended a rally, and, with CB radios, began patrolling the east side all night in their cars. The undersheriff conveyed his dismay over this development in a B article on May 20th. Essentially, his message was, "Please don't." The citizen manhunt pushed on undeterred, accompanied by the noise and light of a surveillance helicopter on loan from the California Highway Patrol that circled relentlessly overhead. Another example, an article in the Sacramento Union on May 22nd. Two victims recall East Area Rapist. Quoted Jane using a pseudonym. There were enough identifying details that the ear, reading it, would have known who it was, which makes what she said all the more remarkable. I'd feel cheated if someone blew his head off. I'd ask them to please aim low, she said. That Friday morning, May 27th, the start of Memorial Day weekend, Fiona Williams, all Williams family names are pseudonyms, did some chores around the house, then took her 3-year-old son, Justin, with her to Jumbo Market on Florin Road to shop for groceries. She dropped him at the babysitter's and went to an optometrist appointment. She picked up her paycheck at the library, where she worked part-time, deposited it at the bank, and did some more shopping at Penny's. After that, she picked up Justin at the sitter's, and they went to Mel's coffee shop for dinner. When they got home, they swam for a while in the pool. Around dusk, she watered the front lawn, still in her swimsuit, as Justin toddled around. Fiona was aware of what was happening, of course. The local TV news blared with fresh hysteria every night. But she wasn't necessarily on high alert. He was the East Area Rapist, after all. He'd never hid in South Sacramento, the neighborhood where Fiona lived in a new house with her husband, Philip, and Justin. But the ear lingered in their minds. Philip worked as a supervisor at a water treatment plant in Del Deo. The most recent victims, the couple attacked on May 17th, lived just yards from the plant. Philip worked the swing shift, so when he came in, his colleagues had filled him in on the swarming police presence across the way. The ear had put a gun to the husband's head. "Shut up. If you say one more thing, I'll kill. Do you understand?" Philip didn't know the couple. They were strangers cloistered behind police cars, the subject of murmured workplace gossip. But he would come to know them soon. When Philip returned home from work around 12:30 a.m., Fiona and Justin were asleep. He drank a beer and watched some television, then climbed into bed and dozed off. About 20 minutes later, he and Fiona woke at the same time and reached for each other. They began fooling around. Several minutes later, a scratching sound in the bedroom startled them. The sliding glass door to the patio opened, and a man in a red ski mask entered. That they knew instantly who it was didn't lessen the shock. The feeling was surreal, as if a larger-than-life movie character, someone you'd just been watching on television, emerged from behind the drapes and began talking to you. He carried a 2-cell flashlight in his left hand. He held what looked like a .45 pistol in his right hand, extending it into the flashlight's beam to show them. "Lay perfectly still, or I will kill all of you," he said. "I will kill you. I will kill her. I will kill your little boy." He threw a length of cord at Fiona and ordered her to tie up Philip. The ear tied her next. He rummaged and threatened, slashing his flashlight across the bedroom in jarring motions. He stacked plates on Philip's back, then led Fiona into the living room. "Why are you doing this?" she asked him. "Shut up," he hissed at her. "I'm sorry," she said impulsively in response to being yelled at. Shut up! He pushed her onto the living room floor, where he'd already laid down towels. After raping her several times, he said, I have something for you to tell the fucking pigs. They got it mixed up the last time. I said I would kill two people. I'm not going to kill you. If this is on the TV or in the papers tomorrow, I'll kill two people. Are you listening? Do you hear me? I have TVs in my apartment, and I'll be watching them. If this is on the news, I'll kill two people. When he mentioned the TVs in his apartment, an image flashed in Fiona's mind of LBJ in the Oval Office, watching a trio of televisions he had next to his desk, a clip often played on the news back in the 60s. The ear noticeably stuttered on L words, particularly listening. His breathing was rapid, loud, sucking inhalations. She almost hoped he was faking, because if he wasn't, he sounded seriously unhinged. It scares my mommy when it's on the news, he said between gulping breaths. It was a little after 4 a.m. when the first officer entered the opened rear patio door, hesitantly making his way toward the woman calling out to him. She lay face down on her living room floor, naked, her wrists and ankles tied behind her with shoelaces. A ski-masked stranger had just spent an hour and a half terrorizing Fiona and her husband. He brutally raped her. Fiona was 5'2", 110 pounds, a wisp of a woman. She was also a native Sacramentan, in possession of a dry, matter-of-fact manner, a clear-eyed resilience that belied her petite size. "Well, I guess the East Area rapist is the South Area rapist now," she said. This was the only known ear attack in the South Area. The dentist who co-founded the Ears Patrol and offered the $10,000 reward, which had been well publicized in the week leading up to the attack, had a practice less than half a mile away, which may or may not have been purely coincidental. Shelby arrived at the yellow house with brown trim at 5 a.m. A crime scene technician had laid plastic bags over the area on the floor where the rape occurred to preserve evidence. A green wine bottle and two packages of sausages were scattered on the back patio, about 15 feet from the door. Shelby accompanied the bloodhound and his tracker as the dog nosed its way through the backyard toward a flower bed in the northeast corner, where they found shoe impressions. Highway 99 ran adjacent to the house, and where the dog lost the scent, at a spot on the shoulder of the northbound lanes, were tire tracks from what looked to be a small foreign car, a VW Bug, maybe. A technician pulled out a measuring tape. The tire tracks measured 4 feet 3 inches center to center. Right after the attack, when the investigators with their notepads asked Fiona to search her mind, the only thing she could point to that was slightly odd that evening was the garage door. She'd been going back and forth from the house to the garage doing laundry, and she was certain the side door leading to the carport had been closed. When she came back in one time, the door stood open. The wind, she thought. She closed and locked the door. They'd only lived in the house for 3 weeks and were adjusting to its contours and quirks. It was a corner house, boasting 4 bedrooms and an in-ground pool in the backyard. One image that would continue to nag at Fiona was that of a man at the realtor's open house, standing next to her as they looked out at the pool at the same time. She didn't know why the impression stayed with her. Had he stood too close? Stayed a beat too long? She tried in vain to build a face, but he was blank. A man. That was all. Highway 99 ran adjacent to the house, separated by 100 yards of dirt and a row of large conifers. Directly behind them, on the other side of a dinky, chain-link fence, was an empty lot. Fiona would come to view the open space around them differently than she first had. What was once a pleasant expanse became a vulnerable point of entry. It wasn't part of their original plan, but after what happened to them that Memorial Day weekend, she and Philip spent $3,000 they couldn't afford to build a brick wall around their new house. Shelby noted the realtor's sold sign on the front porch. One of the significant avenues in the investigation was trying to find a common thread among the victims. The detectives gave the victims detailed questionnaires and carefully examined their checks. Areas of interest, or backgrounds that seemed overrepresented, included students and education, medical workers, and the military. Several were noted to have frequented the same pizza restaurant. But by far the most recurrent pattern was real estate. At Jane's, the first attack Shelby investigated, back in October 76, he observed a Century 21 sign on a lawn directly across the street. Several victims had just moved in, were moving out, or were next door to new units being sold. As one decade turned to the next and the case grew more complex, the real estate factor would consistently crop up. Its significance, if any, remaining murky, right up to the moment a realtor casually extracted a key from a lockbox and stumbled upon the ear's last known victim, a beautiful girl, unrecognizable in death. After Fiona and Philip's attack on Memorial Day weekend, the ear disappeared from Sacramento for the summer. He wouldn't return until October. By then, Shelby was off the case, reassigned back to patrol. His skirmishes with the higher-ups had begun to flare more openly. High-profile cases are magnets for hierarchical politics, and Shelby could never quite play the game. When he first made detective in 1972, his boss, Lieutenant Ray Root, had a loose, proactive philosophy. Go out and develop informants, Root instructed, and uncover felonies that might never be reported. Develop your own cases rather than wait to be assigned. That philosophy suited Shelby's temperament. Showing courteous interest in his boss's ideas did not. The transfer didn't upset him, he insists. He was stressed from the manhunt. Exhausted by the infighting. Working a high-profile case like the ear meant constant scrutiny, and Shelby bristled at the surveillance. Inside him lived the memory of that proud young man standing hopefully in front of the sheriff's department panel, dismissed because it was decided he was lacking the right parts. In the days after her attack, Fiona found herself stuttering as the ear had. Carol Daly organized a meeting among the female victims at one of their homes. Fiona recalls a lot of murmured exchanges. You're doing so well, and I didn't leave my home for 5 days. Daly played for them a couple of recordings of male voices, but Fiona doesn't remember any of the victims recognizing them. For some time afterward, she became irrational about personal safety. At night, she refused to go into the back of the house where the bedroom was until Philip came home. She sometimes kept a loaded gun under the driver's seat of her car. She found she had a lot of nervous energy, and one night, when she was using it to furiously vacuum, she blew a fuse, and the whole house and backyard went dark. She became hysterical. Her neighbors, a kind elderly couple who knew what had happened, rushed over and fixed the fuse. During a break from work not long after the attack, Philip walked over to the other victim's home and introduced himself. He didn't tell Fiona until years later, but he and the other husband would meet sometimes in the early morning hours to ride around in a car together, scanning yards and empty lots, speeding up, slowing down, looking for the outline of a figure slinking along hedges. The two men's bond was unspoken. Few men would experience what they had, would understand the shattering rage of lying face down on a bed, bound and gagged as your wife whimpers from another room. They hunted a man whose face they didn't know. Didn't matter. The action of moving forward, their hands unrestrained, of physically doing something, was all that did. An excerpt from an article published on February 28, 1979, in the now-defunct chain of suburban weekly newspapers known locally as the Green Sheet, might help convey what Sacramento was like in the 1970s. Three rape trials loom, is the headline, with the subhead, Questions of Publicity. The first paragraph. The public defender's office will attempt to prove publicity about the East Area rapist makes it impossible for three men charged with multiple rapes to get a fair trial in Sacramento County. In February 1979, the East Area rapist hadn't attacked in Sacramento County in 10 months. Signs indicated he'd moved on and was prowling the East Bay. Yet the article describes how the public defender's office was conducting phone surveys of Sacramento residents, trying to gauge to what extent an aura of fear exists in this community because of the East Area rapist. The public defender's office worried that the East Area rapist's top dog infamy would poison the jury pool, that jurors would convict their clients, the Woolly, Midday, and City College rapists, in a misguided attempt to punish the unidentified offender whose moniker still caused such terror that many potential survey responders, upon hearing the caller's question, didn't get past the four words, "the East Area Rapist," before hanging up. It might help convey what Sacramento was like in the 70s to know that in an article about three serial rapists overshadowed by a fourth, a fifth at-large serial rapist isn't even mentioned. The early bird rapist was active in Sacramento from 1972 to early 76, when he seemed to go underground. 4 years of break-ins and sexual assaults and approximately 40 victims. And yet a Google search shows references to him only in relation to the ear. A woman wrote me an email about a close encounter she believes she had with the East Area Rapist when she was a teenager. She and a friend were taking a shortcut to their high school in Arden Arcade, a neighborhood on Sacramento County's east side. She remembers the morning was cold and believes it was either fall or winter of 1976 or 77. They decided to walk down a cement path that ran along a creek and ended up hitting a dead end, a fenced-in backyard. When they turned around, a man was standing 20 feet from them. He wore a black ski mask that covered his face except for his eyes. He started toward them, keeping one hand in his jacket. The woman, thinking quickly, reached her hand up and felt around for a lock on the fence. The gate pushed open, and the two friends ran screaming into the backyard. The homeowners, alerted by the racket, came out and herded them into the house. She remembers being interviewed by investigators at the time. She was writing to tell me that the masked man was built differently than I'd described in my magazine article about the ear. The man she encountered was extremely muscular, the woman wrote. Overkill, so. I forwarded the email to Shelby, now retired from the Sacramento Sheriff's Department. Probably did see the ear, he wrote back. However, muscle description sounds like Richard Kissling perfectly. Richard Kissling? I looked Kissling up, yet another serial rapist once active in the Sacramento area, who, like the ear, wore a ski mask and tied up the husbands while he raped their wives. Sacramento's was not an isolated problem. U.S. crime rates show a steady rise in violent crime throughout the 1960s and 70s, peaking in 1980. Taxi Driver came out in February 1976. The bleak and violent film was hailed as an encapsulation of its time, to no one's surprise. Many retired cops I talked to, from Sacramento but other places too, uniformly recall 1968 to 1980 as a particularly grim period. And unlike some other places, Sacramento, a city built by pioneers who forded rivers and passed over snowy mountain ranges to get there, is known for its flinty survival instincts. My point is not to declare a plague, but to underscore prominence. In a city inhabited by tough locals and lousy with violent offenders, one predator stood out. It might help convey what Sacramento was like in the 1970s, and something about the ear, to know that whenever I tell an inquiring native that I'm writing about a serial rapist from Sacramento, no one has ever asked which one. Visalia. Editor's note. The following chapter was pieced together from Michelle's notes and early drafts of the Los Angeles Magazine article, In the Footsteps of a Killer. One Friday morning in late February of 1977, Richard Shelby was at his desk at the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department when his phone rang. On the other end was a Sergeant Vaughn of the Visalia PD. Vaughn thought he had potentially useful information for their ear investigation. From April 1974 until December of the following year, Visalia had been plagued by a rash of bizarre burglaries committed by a young offender they dubbed the Ransacker. The Ransacker struck as many as 130 times over a period of less than 2 years, but there had been no activity since December of 1975, and the ear series began in Sacramento just 6 months later. Moreover, there seemed to be a host of similarities between the two offenders. Perhaps it was an angle worth exploring. The Ransacker was as prolific as he was weird. He often hit multiple homes in one night, sometimes four, sometimes five, once as many as a dozen. The Ransacker targeted the same four residential neighborhoods repeatedly. He preferred personal items like photographs and wedding rings, leaving behind things of greater value. Investigators noted that he seemed to have a thing for hand lotion. But he was a perv with a mean streak, and with an apparent bone to pick with the domestic unit. If there were family photos around, he'd tear them up or hide them, sometimes breaking the picture frames, sometimes stealing the photos entirely. He'd pour orange juice from the refrigerator onto clothing from the closet, like a bratty child with a bad temper. He'd thoroughly trash the place. This seemed to be his paramount objective over theft, hence his moniker. For good measure, he'd remove cash from its hiding places and leave it on the bed. He'd stick to stealing trinkets and personalized jewelry, piggy banks and redeemable blue-chip stamps. He unplugged appliances and clock radios. He liked to take single earrings from pairs. The ransacker was big on spite. The sexual element of the ransacker's burglaries was evident in his penchant for rifling through female undergarments, often leaving them strewn about or posed. In one instance, he piled them in a baby's crib. On another occasion, he neatly laid out the man's underwear in a line down the hallway, extending from the bedroom to the bathroom. He had a knack for knowing where to find anything in the house that could be used as lubricant, with a particular affinity for Vaseline intensive care hand lotion. He was also shrewd. He'd almost always leave more than one point of escape open, so that if the homeowners returned before he was finished, he'd have multiple exit options. He'd implement his own makeshift alarm system by placing items like perfume bottles or spray cans on the doorknobs. In the early morning hours of September 11th, 1975, the ransacker's criminal path made a frightening pivot. It was around 2 a.m. The 16-year-old daughter of Claude Snelling, a journalism professor at College of the Sequoias, awoke to find a man straddling her, his gloved hand cupped tightly over her mouth. A knife was pressed against her neck. "You're coming with me. Don't scream, or I'll stab you," the ski-masked intruder whispered in a raspy voice. As she began to resist, he produced a gun. "Don't scream, or I'll shoot you." He led her out the back door. Snelling, alerted by the noise, ran out onto the patio. "Hey, what are you doing? Where are you taking my daughter?" he shouted. The intruder took aim and fired one round. It hit Snelling in the right side of his chest and spun him around. Another shot was fired, and this bullet struck Snelling in his left side, traveling through his arm before piercing his heart and both lungs. He staggered into the house and was dead within minutes. The assailant kicked his victim three times in the face before running away. He was a white male, about 5'10", with angry eyes, the intended victim reported to police. Ballistics tests revealed that the handgun used in the crime was a Morocco 38 that had been stolen in a ransacker burglary 10 days earlier. Investigators also learned that in February of that year, Claude Snelling had returned home to find a peeper crouched beneath his daughter's window. He chased the subject, but lost him in the darkness. Evidence strongly pointed to the ransacker. Nighttime police presence was ramped up, with surveillance units assigned for nocturnal stakeouts. One residence of particular interest was a house that had been targeted three times before on West Kaweah Ave, in an area of heavy ransacker activity. On December 10th, Detective Bill McGowan startled the ransacker outside of the house. The suspect vaulted a fence, and a chase ensued. When McGowan fired a warning shot, the suspect gestured in surrender. "Oh my God, don't hurt me," he squeaked in an oddly mannered, high-pitched voice. "See? My hands are up." The baby-faced man turned slightly, sneakily, and drew a gun from his coat pocket, promptly firing it at McGowan. McGowan fell backward, and things suddenly went dark. The bullet had struck the officer's flashlight. On January 9th, 1976, Visalia police detectives Bill McGowan and John Vaughn rose early and drove 3 hours south to Parker Center, the LAPD's headquarters in downtown Los Angeles. McGowan had recently come face-to-face with a criminal whose ability to elude authorities defied the laws of logic, and whose capture, it's fair to say, consumed the entire Visalia Police Department. His encounter with the ransacker was considered an important break in the case, and so arrangements were made with a special investigative unit of the LAPD for McGowan to undergo hypnosis, with the hope that new details might be elicited. At Parker Center, the two Visalia detectives met with Captain Richard Sandstrom, director of the LAPD's hypnosis unit. They briefed Sandstrom on the details. McGowan drew a diagram of the residential neighborhood where his confrontation with the ransacker took place. A police artist created a composite sketch based on McGowan's input. The group then convened to room 309. Diagram and composite were laid on the table in front of McGowan. At 11:10 a.m., the hypnosis session began. Sandstrom quietly encouraged McGowan to relax. Legs were uncrossed, fists unclenched, breathing deepened. He directed the detective's memory back a month, to the evening of December 10, 1975. That night, a half-dozen police officers had been deployed in the neighborhood around Mount Whitney High School, some in fixed, hidden locations, others on foot, and one in an unmarked vehicle. The goal of the coordinated stakeout was to detect and apprehend their greatest adversary, the Visalia ransacker. The night before, McGowan had taken a call of particular interest. The caller identified herself as Mrs. Hanley, not her real name, from West Cahuilla Avenue. She was calling about shoe tracks. Did he remember what he'd told her about checking around for shoe tracks? He did. In July, the Hanley's 19-year-old daughter, Donna, also not her real name, had encountered a ski-masked intruder in their backyard. Upon reporting the incident, she was advised by McGowan to check her backyard periodically for shoe tracks and alert him if any turned up. Well, they had. On the basis of this information, McGowan was assigned to stake out the residence the following evening. In his chair at the Parker Center, under the hypnotherapist's guidance, McGowan's mind eased back into that night. He chose to position himself in a front-facing garage at 1505 West Cahuilla Avenue. He had a feeling the ransacker might return to the Hanley house, where his tennis shoe impressions had been observed under Donna's bedroom window. At 7 p.m., McGowan set up his simple surveillance operation. He kept the garage door open. All the lights were shut off. He sat in the dark, watching the neighbor's house through a side window, but also keeping an eye out for anyone passing the garage. An hour went by. Nothing moved. Another half hour passed. Then, around 8:30 p.m., a crouching figure crept by the window. McGowan waited. The figure appeared in the garage doorway and looked around. Possibilities cycled through McGowan's head. The homeowner? A fellow officer? But his eyes had adjusted to the dark, and he could see that the figure was dressed in black and crowned with a watch cap. McGowan observed as the figure moved along the side of the garage toward the rear of the structure. The subject had a large, ungainly frame, oddly proportioned. McGowan walked outside and followed, shining his flashlight on the figure as he fiddled with a side gate. Vaughn, his colleague, took notes as McGowan, under hypnosis, recounted what happened next. The surprise confrontation, the chase into the backyard, the scream like a woman's scream. Oh my God, don't hurt me! Was it a woman? Sandstrom, the hypnotist, asked McGowan. No, he said. McGowan kept his Kel-Lite flashlight fixed on the figure running from him and shouted repeatedly for him to halt. The ransacker appeared to be hysterical, screaming, Oh my God, don't hurt me! Don't hurt me! Over and over, darting this way and that, finally diving over a short slate fence into an adjacent yard. McGowan grabbed his service revolver from his holster and fired a warning shot into the ground. The ransacker froze and wheeled around. He raised his right hand in surrender. I give up, he quavered. See? See, I've got my hands up. Remembering the moment during hypnosis pulled McGowan into a deeper trance. He fixated on the face illuminated in the beam of his flashlight. Baby. Round. Soft-looking baby. Doesn't even shave. Very light skin. Soft, round, baby face. Baby. Standing at the fence, McGowan must have been exhilarated. The grueling 18-month manhunt was over. He was seconds from collaring a criminal who'd remained so cunningly invisible that more than one officer had wondered if they were chasing a ghost. But the Visalia ransacker was real, and a bad man. Yet their evil adversary was hardly intimidating in the flesh. A doughboy, McGowan thought, haplessly plodding around, begging in a high-pitched whimper for McGowan not to hurt him. McGowan didn't intend to hurt him. He was a religious man, an old-fashioned, by-the-book cop. The thrill was in knowing the nightmare was over. The creep was toast. McGowan started over the fence to arrest him. But the ransacker had raised only his right hand in surrender. With his left hand, he withdrew a blue steel revolver from his coat pocket and fired with unambiguous aim straight at McGowan's chest. Fortunately, McGowan had his flashlight at arm's length in front of him, muscle memory from police training more than anything else. The bullet struck the lens. The force of the shot knocked McGowan back. His partner, alerted by the gunfire, sprinted into the yard and saw McGowan motionless on the ground. Thinking he had been shot, he ran to where he thought the ransacker had fled, radioing for help at the same time. Suddenly he heard movement behind him. He whipped around. It was McGowan. Powder burns streaked his face. His right eye was red. Otherwise, he was fine. "There he goes," McGowan said. 70 officers from 3 different agencies sealed off a 6-square-block area. But nothing. The awkwardly built man-child ran away and disappeared into the night, a moth swallowed by the dark, leaving behind a sock full of collectible coins and jewelry, and 2 books of blue-chip stamps. McGowan's account of the ransacker's distinctive appearance and his bizarre manner was consistent with reports of previous close encounters Visalians had with the near-ubiquitous Peeping Tom. They decided he never went outside during daylight hours. He was that pale. The few people who'd glimpsed him remarked on his complexion. It's hard to maintain the skin tone of a fish's underbelly in Visalia, a farm town in central California where temperatures top 100 degrees in the summer. To understand why his pallor marked him as unusual, it helps to know that Visalia is heavily populated with descendants of Dust Bowl refugees. Native Visalians follow an internal clock set by nature. They remember the epic floods, anticipate the droughts, lean against pickups and watch ash fall from wildfires torching chaparral and timber 40 miles away. The outdoors isn't a concept, but hard fact. Sun damage is shorthand for knowledge and trust. It says, I understand what it means to hedge a citrus tree. I know that to chop cotton means to hack weeds from cotton plants with a hoe. I've drifted down the St. John's River on an inner tube. Alkali dust from my feet dissolving into water the color of weak coffee. His paleness conveyed no such local familiarity. It was uncommon and therefore suspicious. It suggested a cloistered life spent plotting. His pursuers in the Visalia Police Department didn't know who he was or where he shut himself away. They knew he moved around at night. They had a good idea of what drew him out. To the teenage girls closing their bedroom curtains, he registered as a glint in the shadows, a flicker of stray light that made them pause. But it was hard to see clearly at night. It was sometime in the winter of 1974 when Glenda, not her real name, a 16-year-old who lived on West Feimster, was pulling her curtains shut and happened to glance down, noticing a marbly, moon-shaped object in the bushes. Curious, she raised her bedroom window for a closer inspection. The moon-faced object returned her stare, a screwdriver clenched in its left hand. Like that, he was gone. Where hard, small eyes had been, there was darkness. Skittering sounds could be heard, like some creature with a muscly tail running from light. Bushes rustled. Fences thudded. The clambering grew fainter. But it didn't matter. A distress call drowned out everything else. At the time, in 1974, Visalia businesses closed at 9 p.m., and trouble was mostly confined to men huddled around irrigation ditches fighting over water rights. But there was no mistaking the sound when you heard it. Movies don't capture the effect of the real thing. It's impossible to reproduce in a studio. Conversations stop. Heads jerk. Eardrums pound with dread. For nothing signals terror like a teenage girl's wild, unrestrained scream in the night. The paleness of the stranger's face wasn't its only unsettling feature. A week after the prowling incident, Glenda's boyfriend, Carl, not his real name, was waiting for her outside her house. It was an early autumn evening, warm still, already dark. Glenda's house was similar to others in the middle-class neighborhood near Mount Whitney High School in southwest Visalia. Single-story, solidly built in the 1950s, at roughly 1,500 square feet, not especially large. Carl sat on the lawn, his presence shadowed in contrast to the glow cast from the bright